Welcome to the bookshelf. On a cold and slippery winter night, let's cuddle up with some poetry. First, Railtown Almanac and its two editors and creators, Jeffrey Dodd and Tom Caraway.
From the back cover of Railtown Almanac, this is One More Song by Vachel Lindsay. All I can bring is one more song, though I have brought you 1,001. So it will be till my life is done. I would set right the old man's wrong. I would outbuild New York and Rome. But all I can bring home is one more song.
Vachel Lindsay's One More Song, which is on the back page, as was just mentioned, of Railtown Almanac. This new collection of, I think it's 86 poets from this area that was put together by Tom Caraway and Jeffrey Dodd, who are both with me. What made you folks put together a poetry collection?
Oh, goodness. Blind ambition. Unruly aspiration.
There were so many things happening in Spokane. Spokane Shorties, Lilac City Fairy Tales, all of the kind of national press that folks like Sean Vestal and Sharma Shields had generated this year alone. You know, and Jess kind of always being in the background as this monolithic Spokane literary figure.
Jess Walter.
And we wanted something for poetry as well. There's poetry in Spokane Shorties and in Lilac City Fairy Tales, but also prose, and we wanted something that was primarily poetry, because there is such a broad range of poets working in the Spokane area.
Did you start with Railtown Almanac as a operative method, or did that just come along as the poems came along?
No, I think from the beginning we envisioned Railtown Almanac being the venue, the forum for these poems to ultimately take shape. I think even more fundamental than Railtown Almanac as a concept was the foundational commitment that Tom and I had to really representing, as he just said, the wide range of poetic voices in Spokane. So it was fundamentally important for us to include well-established figures, people like Chris Howell and Nance Van Winkle and Todd Marshall and the folks like that, as well as people who don't probably self-identify as poets or don't regularly practice the craft of poetry, but have certainly a contribution to make. And so we envisioned Railtown Almanac as a sort of home for this really divergent group of voices, this kind of polyphonic choir that you see in fits and bursts around town at different times of the year, but is too big, really, to ever take shape at one time in one space. And we wanted to try to figure out if we could remedy that.
Many of our poets are Spokane residents. Some had been Spokane residents, but no longer lived in town and had moved on to other parts. And so we've had a half dozen Railtown readings that the residents have had a chance to read at if they were interested in doing so. And so we wanted to give voice to some of those who weren't able to join us in person. Sitting on a Wooden Bench by My Grandmother's Garden in Colbert, Washington, by John Allen Taylor. Remembering James Wright. A tree frog sits in my hand, heavy, like three cold pennies, and shifts back and forth on soft feet. Across the gravel road, a buck and two does pull at the bitter knapweed and I, my grandmother's roses. They will wait until I pluck a few hips for tea and go inside for the evening. Behind them, a yellow tamarack reaches toward an early moon, shouldering a hawk's nest. I lean back, feel the night settle on my forearms, wait for the chicken hawk to come home. John Allen Taylor, after receiving a fellowship from Emerson College in Boston to attend their MFA in creative writing, is in the process of uprooting, moving, and transplanting himself on the other coast. His hobbies will undoubtedly continue in an Eastern fashion and include socializing with feral kittens, making candles, and collecting restaurant ware.
This is Watching an Eastbound Freight Train from My Northerly Window by Dan Morris. It's so late now, the street signals have turned to blinking. There isn't time for wordy sentences. If leaves were in the trees, they might have something to say. I would surely listen. The occasional car on I-90 slips past this dying city like a yawn. All I have is this window and the static of night. 3 engines and 32 boxcars so far. The average is 100. Will they stop in Missoula or continue on to Chicago? A moving mile of metal drives me. I feel the clank of wheel and track, the screaming steel. It is more hopeful at this 3 a.m. than waking at dawn. Dan Morris teaches writing and literature at Auburn University. His chapbook, Following the Day, was published by Pudding House Publications. His work has appeared in Connecticut Review, The Cape Rock, Poetry South, Rock and Sling, and Xavier Review, among others.
Blue Spark by Joshua Robbins. Back deck, Adirondack, evening hums. Fly-by-nights, kamikaze iridescence into the zapper's electric blue. Due west and past the river, thunderclouds, horizon, summer's thirsty ridgeline, and I, moth to fluorescence, stalk the moon. Once, in a bar's back booth, I was flesh-jolted AC. In the dance floor's strobe, I radiated Play-Doh, the Whitman-esque, flashed the poetry of drag and chrome, glittered vinyl, tiger print. Outside, the city's turbines churned the river's darkness white. Now, summer rain on oil-stained driveways, backed-up gutters, the low river's drift. Lightning spikes. I inhale the night, lawn mist, insect char, beyond the clouds, the electric moon. Joshua Robbins lives in San Antonio. Blue Spark appeared in his book Praise Nothing, published by the University of Arkansas Press in 2013.
Dear Gamma Ray Burst 140419A by Christina McDonald. By the time you read this, you'll be dead. A footprint of light in the sky, and then nothing. It's like the discovery of anger when you're 5, only a pinprick, and yet. I ran over an animal last year, something small and gray. I felt a jolt in my sternum, but when I looked in the mirror, it was gone. I'm not afraid of dying, but I was afraid to look in the coffin at my aunt's funeral. We dress our dead up like dolls, and I didn't even know her, would never know the color of her eyes. I can only imagine everything you've seen and swallowed and left behind. Everything burns brighter in the darkness, and the truth is I never noticed you were there. Yesterday, an antelope forgot her name. Yesterday, a clouded leopard was born. 12 billion years ago, a star exploded, and yesterday I mourned you for the first time. The truth is, you've always been dead. But tonight, I can hold my hand up to the sky and fit the shell of you between my fingers. I can carry you with me like a piece of bone the universe forgot to bury. Christina McDonald was a student in the EWU, Inland Northwest Center for Writers, and also the poetry editor for Willow Springs. She has a chapbook, Stories I Tell My Godmother, forthcoming from Dancing Girl Press.
Love Poem by Jane Brightwell Ligon. We smoked cigarettes and watched the stars, more stars than we had ever seen, and we lay on the cold winter road to look up. We already knew we were in love, the kind of love that slept and stirred and woke up screaming, its face all fresh and bleary. It didn't matter, then, what loves had come before or what loves would come after, just that we'd known each other 13 days, and this was the kind of love that we'd remember, the kind that happened all at once and burned like all the stars. We talked like we knew important things, like we were some great philosophers, and maybe we were, because how else could we love like this? How else could we fall without some fear that one day it would end? Maybe we had known each other years ago, before we, now, were born, and the universe had somehow brought us back together, if the universe does things like that. We smoked cigarettes and watched the stars all spilled out in the sky, all burning years ago, their light not reaching us till now. Jane Brightwell Ligon lived in Spokane from the time she was 8 to the time she was 18. Spokane held her as she went through school, fell in love, out of love, and became an adult. Though she lives in Seattle now, attending the University of Washington for writing and graphic design, Spokane will always be home.
Fragments by Jackson Holbert. 1. We dipped our shoulders beneath the heat and found whiskey in the earth. Cars passed. Passengers stared. And still darkness eased its way across the scab land. And still we persisted. 2. Grandma, dead at 80 of emphysema, who scoured the reservoirs for arrowheads, speaks. Tells me, no, no, only the penny slots. Don't want them Indians too rich now, do we, boy? I see her dry waterfall of a face in the cheap pine coffin her sons were too weak or fat to lower on their own. 3. Uncle George, Custer. Dead at 18, 19, 21, 22, 23, 28, 33, 41, and 59. Who, with Coyote, a friend of his who, after his wife kicked him out, stayed in a motorhome by George's double wide for 8 years, once took me hunting with a water-cooled machine gun. Lights up the sky with $3,000 worth of fireworks every 4th. I hear gravy drip from his beard, his mouth open, teeth all awry. His truck has no brake shoes. He says he'll fix them when the emergency wears out. 4. Every September, the air would gasp beneath the bluegrass burns of Idaho. They're illegal now. There's a feeling they used to give me. The way fires dove past the seeds, trying to find something deeper in the soil. The way the coffee-stained horizon coughed up bits of darkness. The way smoke, made of so many small machines, so many moving parts, leaked light. Jackson Holbert is originally from Nine Mile Falls, Washington, and now studies English and creative writing at Brandeis University. His work has appeared or is forthcoming in Tupelo Quarterly, Thrush Poetry Journal, A Minor Magazine, Camrock Press Review, among others.
Life by Tom I. Davis. Tiny twitters darting in and out amongst the cottonwood foliage, chirruping in a most elegant tone, while on the north shore three mergansers hold lackadaisically in the backwash. Downstream, a dozen geese emit a strong hello, then are off the water, streaming in a 6-to-a-wing goose formation over my head, squawking code. Deliriously and deliriously, I am eased into my faint role of nothing but color, churn, and slap of water. Morning light streaming under the bridge above the waterfall, and each particle of my being and non-being holds knowing of your being, of your benevolence, in spite of everything, loving me.
True Love in the Bushes by Tom I. Davis. I love best the knocked down, roughed up, empty natural places in our city where no foot but mine has entered, ever, from before time, even before nurture was needed as a verb. On voting day, the indenture to ill-considered caring is mediated in the meat grinder, a harlequin demagogue of belief about faith, when all it is a tight grip and a loose lip naming joy, joy. Or managing a small family, and the city wells up with 200-foot pine throughout all the city out into Idaho, now and then a church spire, a government building, a water tower, but mainly the pines and the calming mountain on the horizon.
This is a contemporary poetry collection, and Tom Davis is probably the only person in here, other than Bechtel Lindsay, who's dead, is that right?
That is right, as far as we know.
And so why does Tom Davis need to be in here?
Well, I think there are a couple of reasons. Maybe the primary one is that for an entire generation of Spokane poets, he really functioned as a kind of central figure around whom many poets sort of found themselves gathering and off of whom they were able to bounce ideas and images and develop their own sort of aesthetic and ethos in Spokane.
Yeah, I think for the long period of time when the presumption was that there weren't really any literary things happening in Spokane outside of the, you know, Masters in Fine Arts program at Eastern, that there wasn't any literature happening in Spokane, and Tom is kind of a figure in contradiction to that idea. There was, in fact, quite a lot happening in Spokane, and Tom was at the center of much of that, and so he has a very important role, I think, in the current development of literary culture in Spokane, because he kept it kind of alive and in people's homes for so long.
Spending time with Jeffrey Dodd and Tom Caraway, who put together Railtown Almanac, what have you learned, what do you feel about poetry in Spokane, having put this book together?
There is certainly a lot going on in Spokane. I think that going into the project, we conceptually thought that was true. But now, with this collection, which doesn't even collect all of the poets in Spokane, even the working poets or non-self-identifying poets, they're still out there, and I've heard from some since the book came out who may not have gotten word and want to get in on the next edition if there is one. And there's just so much, I think Jeff used the word polyphonic, even with an MFA program and the kinds of instructors that Eastern Washington brings, the voices that emerge from that program and that remain in Spokane and that develop independently of that program and that remain in Spokane are so diverse that, you know, this is one book, but it's so many different voices, and I think that's really encouraging and pretty remarkable for a city of our size.
I'd echo that. I mean, there are 150 or so pages of poetry in this book, and we probably could have found 300 pages. We continually come across people who we look at one another and think, why didn't we include her? Or how did we not discover him? And I suspect that will continue to occur over the coming months and the next year as we sort of look back on this volume and wonder what might be next.
That's Railtown Almanac, available in bookstores. Now let's go on to a specific poetry book, and that's Tom Marshall's Bugle, which comes out next week.
So here are some poems from my new collection, Bugle. The bugle strikes me as a cacophonous instrument, as an instrument connected to the call to the hunt, the call to the new day, but also an instrument that signals closure. Crash with revisions. Late at nights are swerving onto the shoulder where a slammed door shook me awake. Dad ran toward a pickup flipped in the ditch, a man draped out the window. And before my mother could hold me, I followed red brake lights. The driver tried to speak, said pasture, passin, passenger. We found a leg ending in a sneaker. My father barfed. The right blinker flashed. I wanted to crawl through the window and switch it off. Sirens, troopers, useless ambulance, the start of vacation. We rented a boat, fished in silence, waiting for hooks to set, tight lines, bent rods, smallmouth bass. I'm trying to find one in here that is a little more upbeat. I might be looking for a while. Meadow. Walk slowly. Lie down and wait for a quiet, black like the inside of a rock, one of those round stones, a glacier left among tiny flowers, that you come upon just off the trail, and say to yourself, how did this get here? Marvel for a moment as you learn to live in a field without a fence, gawking at blossoms. This is the opening poem in the collection. The title Buccinator has roots that send it back to cheeks and cheek muscles and cheekiness, as well as cows and horns. bullock, bucolus, castrated young bull, coiled horn, the long light shakes across the lakes, we buy in bulk. Give me that oral tradition, that ancient wordy call, gums, tongues, and mouths mouthing, eat sucky talk, embouchure, outmoded by the carefree trumpets, toodaloo to Gideon, Joshua, and Saul, infinite surface, finite volume. It might be well to mention here that a bugle is sounded, not blown. O coppery butte, O superfunded blunder, zinky need, a pit is the earth stripped. Regimented troops need their toots, assembly dismiss reveille and tattoo, knock off bright work, man overboard, bayonets, abandon ship, saith the boogie-woogie, the boy, saith me. Birthday poem. My mother turned 60 this week, deep in that stretch where anything can happen. Her mother died at 57. I'm 42, and Dante's Dark Forest, well, let's just say it continues to thicken. And I know what you spiritual people are thinking, muttering koans under your ginger tea breath. It can happen anytime, anywhere, to anyone, and that's why the moon doesn't cling as it slides across the sky. Fine. Last fall, hiking near Priest Lake, I came across a teenage boy covered with blood, sobbing. He held a compound bow with pulleys that looked like they could move the horizon, or at least hurl a razor-edged arrow a couple hundred feet through the breast and heart of a skinny doe, and out again, and into the shoulder of a five-month fawn that still quivered. Cedar scales covered the forest floor, a mossy quilt to hush the pain, and so we pulled on the shaft, but it was stuck in bone. And the fawn mewled, moaned, kicked thin legs, black hooves like chips of coal. I told the kid to find a big rock. Quick. He did, and held it toward me, somehow confused, and I tried to smash the skull, but missed once, shattering the eye socket and breaking the jaw, before ending the pain and walking away among massive trees that held the sound in the harsh ridges of bark. Jesus, Mom, I'd meant to write a happy birthday poem. When I'd gone 100 yards, the quiet beneath the looming cedars was the quiet I felt as a child in your arms. You were a little bit older than that kid. This is the best that I can do. Above the ancient grove, tamaracks lit the hillside in an explosive gold glowing toward dusk. Close your eyes. You can see them. Keep them closed. We'll all blow together and make a wish. Bugle. Joshua said to all the neophytes, "Come here and listen to the words of Todd. This is how you will know that the living Todd is among you, and that he will certainly drive out before you the Canaanites, Hittites, Hivites, Perizzites, Girgashites, Amorites, and Jebusites, the light-bright stalactites, eastbound red-eye flights, bedbugs, chiggers, ticks, and mites, the toddler at daycare who bites, the naked meth freak in your yard last night, men on bicycles wearing spandex tights, cover bands who play afternoon delight, people who moon about geese mating for life, dogs whose barks exceed their bites, these three words together, mocked Frey, our bites." So said Joshua, son of Nun, just before Jericho, to the Neophytes. A little more playful at the end, but I saw in the news the other day that someone had stolen from the entrance to Dachau the sign that had the three words, Arbeit macht frei, and it was unbelievable that someone would go and steal that sign. Maybe it's not that light of a poem, actually.
So what makes you write a poem?
I don't know if there's a single force that makes me write a poem. I think that I'm always writing, and sometimes the words that I'm putting down on a page, whether they're started because I've given myself an exercise, whether they're started because I want to copy some great poem by some writer that I've been reading at that point in time. The words somehow start to coalesce into their own poem, their own shape, their own making. And sometimes that coalescing leads toward a work that I'll eventually call a poem. More often than not, probably 90% of the time, it just ends up another scribble in the notebook.
But you alluded earlier that you would try to look for something less dark.
Mm.
Is it simply because difficulty and darkness takes more effort to explain or understand that poetry is necessary?
This book is called Bugle, and I see one of the energies in it as an attempt to bugle myself awake and perhaps bugle readers awake. I think that we easily slide into a kind of lazy acceptance of all the awfulness unfolding around us when we're inundated with so many bad headlines, when we're inundated with so much travail and grief. It's easy for each of those instances to lose the force that it perhaps should have upon us. And so for this particular book, I think that, you know, there was a nexus of a lot of bad energy connected to news in the world, connected to sorting out personal history, sorting out some political histories, and that led to a darker collection. One way that I've been kind of explaining it to myself is if I were to think of this as my Divine Comedy, and it's a very modest one if it's that, then this is my Inferno, whereas my previous book, Tangled Line, was a sort of purgatorio of working through one's own blunders in this life. And then my first book, Dare Say, is full of a lot more hopefulness and brightness. The last lines of that book are, we shine, we love, we light. And hopefully I'll work back toward that area.
And so that represents kind of the way your poetry, which you create, works for you. Then how do you hope it works for the perceiver? And what do you try to accomplish for the person who reads or listens to it?
I don't think we can ever know for sure exactly how a reader will interact with a poem, how a reader will interpret a poem. But I certainly hope that the poem will initiate some sort of emotional response. Ezra Pound said in one of his essays, only emotion endures. And I think that that's a really primary impetus for me. I also hope that the reader will experience my poems aloud, because I know that the musicality of poetry is central to me. It's the force that first got me interested in poetry. And so that's something I certainly put a lot of energy into in my own work. And I hope that the pleasure that I have making that music is something that the reader can also feel.
So what strategies do you have for a person who picks up a poetry book to go from beginning to end, or just leaf through it, to randomly grab, to read aloud, to read quiet? How do you approach it?
Well, like most poets, I'm grateful when anyone picks up one of my books and buys it or reads it. But, you know, I think that for me personally, Robert Frost's dictum that if a poet write a book of 24 poems, the book itself should be the 25th. Is a tremendously important one for me, and I think of my books as coherent poems, and I try to spread motifs throughout them, echo music throughout them, and try to make a consistent whole. That doesn't necessarily mean, though, that a reader needs to approach my creation that way. I think that whatever works for the individual reader is going to be the best methodology. I think the most important thing for me, and one of the most important things for me as a teacher of poetry, is that the reader approach the poem not thinking that they're approaching a riddle, that the reader approach the poem not thinking that a poet hides deep meaning underneath the surface of the poem. Listen to the poem, experience the poem, make of what you glean from the poem. And don't worry about hidden stuff. I promise you that poets don't ferret things away in the pages.
Todd Marshall's new book of poetry, Bugle. is out and in bookstores. He will be reading from it at the Bartlett next Tuesday the 9th at 6:30. For the Bookshelf, I'm Vern Wyndham. Monday and Tuesday on the Bookshelf, we'll hear from Eleanor and Franklin Roosevelt.